Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist, screenwriter, and essayist Richard Russo is celebrated for his ability to use compassion and humor to capture the lives of America's working class, the men and women who hail from the factory and mill towns that have been left behind as the global economy has evolved. Born and raised in such a town in Gloversville, New York, Russo returns to it in Marriage Story, an American memoir, to chronicle his parents' lives and why their marriage foundered. Ultimately, however, he asks a broader question. Is America going through its own breakup story? Can the divides between rich and poor, black and white, red and blue, educated and not, be overcome, or are they irreconcilable differences that will end up pulling the nation apart? Richard Russo is the author of 9 novels, 2 collections of short stories, a memoir, a book of essays, and several produced screenplays. His novel, Empire Falls, won the 2002 Pulitzer Prize. His most recent novel is the best-selling Chances Are. The newest work is from Scribd Originals, and it is Marriage Story. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Richard Russo to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. What a pleasure to have you back on the program.
Well, it's always great to talk to you, Joe.
Rick, it's always good to talk to you. I so appreciate you taking the time out to do this. This is an interesting, quirky project, so describe how it happened. Scribd is a great company that offers originals, e-books and audiobooks to people, and gives you, people, wonderful writers like you, an opportunity to do essays, 11,000 words or so on subjects. So how did this come to you?
One of the editors there, Amy Grace Lloyd, is somebody that I had worked with before. She was an editor at a now defunct digital magazine called Byliner, and she published a story of mine called Nate in Venice, which had a different title when it came out in that book of essays that you mentioned. We changed the title to Voice there. But she originally published that story in Byliner, and she was just such a savvy editor, somebody that I enjoyed working with so much, that when I had a chance, I got a little note from her saying that at some point that she was with a new company now, and she described a little bit about Scribd. And when I was writing Marriage Story, I thought, boy, this is the perfect place for that, because it's probably it's probably too long even for the New Yorker. And if it's too long for the New Yorker, then where?
Right.
You know?
Exactly.
And so it was the combination of working with somebody that I knew and trusted and really liked a lot and knew would do good things with the fact that it was just a long form piece that was probably not going to find a home in one of the more, you know, traditional publishers. And the other thing that I really loved about Scribd is that, I mean, it has such a large following. I think of it as kind of like a literary Netflix or Hulu.
Right.
But like Netflix and Hulu and some of the other streaming services, Scribd has like 11 million subscribers all over the world. So for this, an American story that I'm writing about. But I think I thought it would be interesting not only for Americans to read, you know, a story about themselves, but for other nations. And my sense is, Joe, other nations right now, really since the election, I think the whole world has its eyes on America right now and wondering what in the world is going to happen if the American democracy, in fact, does not work out. If it turns out that this experiment in democracy that we've been having now for 250 years or thereabouts,
turns out to
be a failure.
I learned a long time ago not to ask the chicken and egg question with authors, because it never really worked out for me. But it seems inevitable in this. Was your initial idea to write about your parents and to go over some of the ground and to write about new things that you didn't write about in Elsewhere, which was the memoir, or was it to look at those American questions?
I think I think that the origin of this story, there were probably two or three origins, as with most things. One is the fact of the pandemic. Honestly, this is I think of this, and I suspect that, you know, 10 years from now, if I'm still around and looking back on it, this will strike me as a pandemic document. I mean, we all went into lockdown a little over a year ago now, and while we were in lockdown, there were the horrors of the election, and also a lot of writers, myself included, had everything that we had planned to do during that year. Everything was suddenly off of our calendars. So any travel plans that we had, any book tours that we would be doing in support of new work or anything like that, all of that was gone. And so I could continue to work on a novel, but suddenly I had this block of time. I had been told to go home and stay there, you know? And so I thought, well, let's see what we can make the best of here. But the other thing that happened, I think, goes back to Trump's presidency and the very first day thereof. I don't know if you remember this, Joe, but the first day after Trump was elected.
Yeah.
I was on NPR because I was called, and I think that I imagine this in my mind of people at NPR saying, "Who out there would know something about Trump voters?" and somebody said, "Russo, doesn't Russo know? Wouldn't Russo know something about that? He writes about the class of people that have now become Trump voters." And I found myself the day after Trump's election on NPR. Trying to explain how such a thing could have happened in America, and I think I realized either then when I was on the air or shortly thereafter that I had suddenly become something in the eyes of readers that I had never been before, and that is a political writer. Even though I had never I steered clear of politics in the traditional sense. But suddenly my work was now going to be looked at in a slightly different way. And the sense that I always had about my work was that it was political, and that I was positioned, maybe not uniquely, but pretty interestingly, I was placed with a foot kind of in both political camps. That is through education, and a good amount of luck, I ended up living a life that was very different from the lives that my mother and father lived, and certainly that my grandparents lived. But coming where I came from, a small upstate New York mill town, if I just looked out my front window, I could take snapshots of an America that was kind of vanishing before our eyes. And that once I realized that, I began to think of myself as an American writer in a slightly different way, but also to think of my parents, how uniquely American they were, despite not being able really to agree about anything about what America really represented for them. They had totally different views of America. And when the pandemic hit, and as we all did, we're all suddenly thinking about our own mortality and what our lives have amounted to and what destiny means and what my own peculiar destiny means. And I think that the need to tell this marriage story, to start with my parents and how differently they viewed America, and then to expand that into an essay that really by the end of it, it's not really their story anymore. It's not my story anymore. It's kind of America's story, or some segment of America's story that will relate to a lot of people, I think.
Marriage Story, an American Memoir, is the latest work from Richard Russo, and he is our guest on the roundtable this morning. I want to talk about the marriage in a moment, but you write toward the end of the essay basically saying that your father wouldn't necessarily have liked Trump, but he certainly would understand the support.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And that was one of the ways that they were fundamentally different. I think that my mother believed that after the Second World War, that all the people in that first wave of immigration, most of whom were represented in the neighborhood in Gloversville where I grew up, the Irish, the Poles, the Italians, the Germans, the Slovaks, all of that first wave of immigration, that when the war was over, that America's gated communities would all be open to them. My father saw no evidence that that was ever going to happen. And at one point in this essay, when just after I finished my PhD and I'm about to start my first job as a professor in Pennsylvania, he said to me, I said something that must have sounded like something my mother would have said, because he looked at me and he said, "You know, they're only going to let you get so far."
Yeah.
And I said, "Who do you mean they?" And he looked at me and he with this sad expression on his face and said, "All that education and you still don't know who they are." And he reminded me that my name ended in a vowel, and that was the reason, because my name ended in a vowel, I would only be able to make it so far in what he saw as America, and he would have understood Trump voters who felt that that their role in this American story had been diminished, their jobs had been sent overseas. More important than that was not just that they'd lost their jobs, but they'd lost their work. They'd lost their sense of what they were contributing to the American fabric. And worse than that, even, they'd not only lost so much and they were worth so much less, but they were also in the process somehow being humiliated, somehow being looked down upon. They didn't have that college degree that would have maybe gotten them into that gated community, into that country club that they had aspired most of their lives to. And like most Trump voters, my father did spend most of his adult life. I mean, he'd come back from the Second World War, a genuine war hero.
Right.
And yet his sense was that in America, he was always going to be somebody whose last name ended in a vowel. And that meant that the deck was stacked against him. And that's what so many Trump supporters believe now, that this new America, which is changing demographically right before their eyes, that the white majority will be a minority in short order. That's what they see. They see an America that will not only be majority white, but will increasingly banish them from their positions of whatever privilege they have left by virtue of the color of their skin.
Meanwhile, your mother was, as you write about in elsewhere, was very excited for you to go to college, so excited that she went with you basically to Arizona, and
yeah.
Which is an amazing story. And then the idea of you going for a PhD, that in her mind it was much different for you to be a professor versus being a writer, and
right.
She saw a difference there. And you even say in this essay that writing that Mohawk unnerved your mother to the point where she asked you, "Will you ever write about people with clean fingernails?" That's an amazing line.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I, you know, my mother said a lot of amazing things over the years. a lot of them have stuck, including that one, because she said that amazing line with, without animosity. It was said with such sadness and such defeat, because, with each novel that I would write about my fictional upstate New York towns, what they all meant to her was, on the one hand, it was wonderful. Look, she was able to say, look, everything I told my son, Rick, about America turned out to be true. I told him to get a college education, and he did. I told him to work hard, and he did. And she had all of these kind of Horatio Alger myth reasons for my success, and she wanted that to be the myth. She wanted that was the legend or the myth that she wanted me to print. That everything that she believed about America, and nothing of what my father believed about America, but everything that she believed about America turned out to be true, and I was for her the living proof of that. The problem was that each novel that I wrote compromised that story, because hers was a story of escape. She wanted to escape that town, escape its limitations, escape its small-mindedness, escape its lack of opportunity. And with each novel that I just went back there, you know, time after time after time, writing about these people with dirty fingernails, you know, doing jobs like working road construction, like my father did, and like I did summers when I was coming home from college. For her, each one of those books was, on the one hand, something that she could crow about. I mean, she could run it up her own personal flagpole and look at it and say, look at my son. Look at the success that he's made of his life through hard work. But each one also convinced her that the clean getaway that she'd been hoping for, you know, that I would not only make my escape, but the escape would be clean. And yes, I'd write a book or two maybe set in that upstate New York mill town because that was what I knew about. But gradually I would learn about this new world that I had entered, and the world that I had entered that she wished for me, the world of a tenured beloved teacher at an American university who maybe writes on the side. And lives in that world with no regrets. With each book that I published, that dream faded a little bit more until, I think, in the end, by the time she died just before Bridge of Sighs was published. No, it was after Bridge of Sighs was published. But with each book, as I dug myself deeper and deeper into the place that I came from, it all felt more and more to her like a terrible defeat. She'd done her best, but in the end, there I was with those people with dirty fingernails.
Richard Russo is our guest this morning. His new work is Marriage Story, an American Memoir. It is a Scribd original. You can find out more information by going to Scribd. S-C-R-I-B-D, Scribd.com. We will continue our conversation with Richard Russo after this short break. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Our guest this morning in this hour, Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist, screenwriter, and essayist Richard Russo, his latest work, Marriage Story, an American Memoir. You write at the beginning of the essay about your father and his gambling, which was one of the excuses that you were given as why the marriage did not work. And I didn't even think, but you write about it
very early in the piece about the connection to Saratoga Racetrack. Not the only form of gambling, but obviously the track was there, and that was something. And then he would go, he would do that. He would also be seen at various pool halls and poker games. And when things got too tough, he would take off, blow town, as you say, and then come back and reemerge. And I bring that up because, well, it gives an insight into the marriage, but also that for your mother, she was worried that she saw you, by being a writer, perhaps as a gambler.
Yes. No, there's no question that she made that connection in her mind, because it came at a point where I was just about to achieve what she hoped that I would achieve, which was a good, stable job. I would be looked up to, and I would have a decent living. My children would be well provided for. And here I was just about to achieve that. And I said, oh, you know what? I've kind of changed my mind here. I think maybe I'll be a writer. What that was like, I think, to her, reminded her of what my father was like when he came back from the war. He was a stranger. And suddenly he was in the grip of something that was much bigger than he was, something that he not only could not defeat, but something that he didn't even want to. He didn't even want to try. He didn't want to do all the things that the other guys that came home from the war wanted to do: take advantage of the GI Bill, get a cheap mortgage, settle down. My father was having exactly none of that. And when I decided that I wanted to be a writer, just take this enormous, enormous leap of faith and turn my back on everything that I had worked so hard for, put my marriage, my children in jeopardy, she saw that as, oh my God, this is genetic. You know, he's in the grip of something just like his father was. And something that, if she was honest, she was as a young woman, pretty impulsive herself. And so I think she thought, the plan was working, and now he is just, he's going to gamble it, and he's going to do what gamblers do. They don't gamble to win, they gamble to lose. And now it's going to happen all over again, and I get to watch it.
You use a term in the book that I hadn't thought of or heard of in years since my mother passed, and I think your mother and my mother were of a very similar generation, and that is nerves. And your mother worked at GE in Schenectady,
yep,
had a very solid job, and by all accounts had it all together until she came home. And
yeah,
and had what you were basically told was nerves. And
yeah,
what you think of that is this paralyzing anxiety and panic and perhaps even depression that so many women of that era did, that when not only untreated, but suppressed to a level that is mind-boggling.
Absolutely. And she came by it rightly. Her mother,
right,
my grandmother was paralyzed by fear and anxiety, which was only exacerbated by the war when both her husband and went off to the South Pacific to fight, and my mother followed my father down to Georgia, where he was going to, before long, ship overseas and married him down there. And she spent much of her life living in terrible, crushing anxiety. And other women in town too. There were women in the neighborhood who got shock treatments. They all had male doctors, and they were unequipped And my sense, remembering back, maybe I'm being too hard on them, but it seems to me that they didn't really care. What they wanted to solve was the fact that these women were driving their husbands crazy, you know, and they were there was something wrong with them, and if they could just get them quiet, then maybe the job was done. And so they put them on drugs. They put them on phenobarbital and stuff like that that they would prescribe back then. They gave them shock treatments. And these women, they had no agency in their own lives at all. And then on top of that, they were narcotized. You know, if they weren't crazy already, they were after they got right through with their doctors. And it was, yeah, you saw it everywhere. And that whole syndrome of what we call now full blown panic attacks, right, was simply, they just gave it a nice soft sounding name, like nerves, and women were just supposed to live with it. And the effects of that, both on the women themselves, but neighborhoods, towns like ours, it was just crushing. I mean, the obsessive compulsive disorder cuts a wide swath through my family, from my grandparents to my mother, to myself, quite frankly, and both of my daughters have had to deal with it. Mm-hmm. But now, I mean, you can find a good doctor. This is very treatable, but it wasn't treatable back then. What I found, strangely enough, in becoming a writer was that all of my obsessive compulsive tics, if you will, my attempts at making order, which is a lot of what obsessive compulsives do. They try to mm-hmm. take things in their lives that are not in their control, and they find little rituals to help them feel like they are in control. For me, writing was exactly the right thing, because all of those impulses that I have towards order are what allows me to be a good reviser, you know, where somebody else would have to touch every mailbox or step on every crack going down the street.
Right.
I just get to revise my sentences 27 times each.
Well, know? And it's
so
you.
I found the right profession for what ails me.
Absolutely.
But most of those women that I grew up with in my neighborhood, and in the house that I grew up with, were undiagnosed and were either untreated or treated exactly wrong.
Shortly before my mother passed, and I think this is 2008, when my mother passed, I started to have issues with anxiety and panic and depression, and this was shortly before her death, and I remember explaining it to, you know, telling her about it, and shocked to learn that she had so much input on what it was like and so many tips on how to deal with it. I told her, I said, I don't know how you can deal with this, how you dealt with this without ever seeing a doctor. And she said, well, the difference between you and me is that I didn't have a choice.
Right.
And I just, that just struck me. And to your point about writing, it's a solitary profession, and it does come down to control, because you are alone in that room and get to control everything. You get to control the narrative.
Yeah. Yeah. And, my mother was right about both of those things. She was right about the gambling. I was gambling. I was in the throes of something stronger than I was, bigger than I was. But what she didn't know, what she couldn't know, is that there were certain habits of being an artist. Never having done anything like that, how would she know?
Right.
But I think about my daughter, Kate, now, whose own first novel just came out a couple of months ago.
She's brilliant, yes.
And when it came time for her to decide to do what she wanted to do with her life, her first career was as a painter, and she's a very talented painter. But the kind of painting that she did was fascinating because what she started doing very, very quickly was painting and drawing within grids, and she would plan her paintings out in advance. And some of them were huge, some of them were small, but they all had these tiny grids that she would map out before she ever picked up a brush. And she would work on these things for hours, and only she knew what she was doing. Mm-hmm. Or why she was doing it. But just in terms of what you were talking about now, I mean, what is that? They turned out to be beautiful paintings, and they turned out to be art, but they also turned out to be an exercise in control. She mm-hmm. wasn't just putting the brush in her hand and saying, let's take a swipe right here and see what it looks like. You know, it was an effort to control the boundaries of what she was going to be doing and what was going to go in this quadrant and what was going to go in that quadrant. And art, strangely enough, lends itself, I think, to that sort of mindset.
One of the things that bowled me over in this essay, because it's a brilliant analysis, and it must have been such an eye-opener to you about your upbringing and your life, but you point out that so much of your grandmother's life was a mystery to you.
Yeah.
And did not become known to you until your late 60s, when your aunt, before her passing, told you these stories about how your aunt in her teen years was basically running the family and getting her to be in the right place at the right time and have some order and control in her life. Fast forward to basically you with your grandmother and even your mother playing that same role.
Absolutely. Yeah. And for me, what was so upsetting about the story that my aunt told me was that it forced me to do something that all good memoirs do, I think. Memoirs are not about what happened. They're about what we make of what happened, and they're about our interpretation of the meaning of what happened. And I had lived 60 some years of my life believing something to be true that it turns out wasn't true, or wasn't completely true. I was going to say wasn't true at all, but no, there was some truth to it, but it certainly wasn't true in the sense that we want something to be true, in the sense that we have full knowledge of what was going on. When I would return from home, in first grade, second grade, third grade, there would be my grandmother waiting for me, welcoming me into the home. My grandfather worked, my mother worked. I wouldn't have had anybody to come home to if it wasn't for my grandmother. And she took that she took that job very seriously. We used to do all sorts of things together. I would come in and we'd sit down and we'd play cards. And when I was really little, going to school for the first time and was frightened, it was she who would take my hand and we would walk to school together. And she'd be there when I got out of school. And I can still envision my very small hand and her large one and thinking what a comfort she was to me. And she was doing this for me. And so for, 60 some years later, something dawns on me that just blows me away, which is that all that time she was being a comfort to me, looking after me, making sure that I was well, making sure that I wasn't terrified, making sure that I knew that everything was going to be okay. I was actually doing perhaps some of that same thing for her, because otherwise, if I hadn't been there, if we hadn't been playing cards, or if she hadn't been walking me to school, the hours of the day that she had to fill in would have been much longer. Those hours were where my mother was gone, where my grandfather, her husband, was gone. She would have been all alone in that house with, she was better by then because my grandfather was home from the war and my mother and I lived right upstairs. She was in much better mental health then than she had been in earlier. But those, I now know, those were long days that she spent, except when I was there, that she spent alone with, I don't know how crippling her anxiety was by then, but I know that it wasn't nothing. And so, yeah, this writing this forced me to come to terms with, you know, those stories. We that's the thing is, I think, Joe, is that we all have these stories.
Right.
We all know more than we think we do. And it's the stopping, it's the pausing, and sometimes the story that somebody tells us that forces us into a different and more sympathetic, more just wise understanding of our own lives.
Toward the end of the essay, you write, "Like her mother before her, mine lived much of her life in terror. Yet at the same time, these women were capable of the kind of courage to which I can only aspire." We get to love such people. Face it, we are, most of us, a mess. We get to love our country, too, and for the same reason. America has never not been a mess. That is, I think, important, as we were just talking about, to understand about our families and to look at it and to understand it, but about our country as well.
Well, Joe, one of the sneakier things that this essay does, I think, is that you're right. That's where this essay is headed. That line that you just read, that's where this essay started some 40 pages earlier. When it started talking about why my parents broke up, I was told, because of my father's gambling. But this essay is all headed to that one observation about America and the fact that it has always been a mess. I say it is sneaky because, most essays begin with a thesis, and then you start looking for evidence in support of that thesis. That's my thesis, but I didn't want to put it in the beginning because I thought I would lose readers immediately.
Right.
You know, those people who think that America has not always been a mess. Well, you lose probably a third to a half of people right there who are not going to write it, who are not going to want to read an essay that comes to that conclusion. So the obvious solution to that is to not get to that conclusion until the very end. Just kind of nick away at it. Here's a little bit of evidence here. Here's a little bit of evidence there. Can we look at this now over here? Here's something that happened. And what happens is that if people accept all those little things as true, by the time you get to the end, you can't really object in quite the same way you would if the author was completely upfront with you and just started with a thesis in the most conspicuous place, the place where we look for the author's main idea at the beginning. So, thank you for reading that section. That's what I was hoping for in this essay, because it's not entirely clear that this, given the events of the last 5 years or so, it's not entirely clear to me that, 50 years from now, we're going to be telling us if the American democracy doesn't make it, we're going to be telling our grandchildren stories about why not. I don't think a simple narrative, a simple story like the one that I was told about why my parents split up, I don't think that's going to fly with anybody. And I think that's, no matter what side of this you think is going to, yes, the American democracy will survive. No, the American democracy won't survive. No matter where you come down on that, on which side you come down on that issue, there are certain things that that I hope we can still agree on, and it's time to start thinking about those. we came pretty close here.
Yeah, and you and I have talked about this before, and we've been having conversations for years and years, going back, I think, to Mohawk. You were not always as willing and interested in talking about Gloversville and talking about that place. And you write in this essay that as the election was coming up last year, that many of your friends were saying, well, look, if Trump wins again, I'm out of here, I'm leaving. And you say that was not anything that you considered. You write, the idea of living in a more just, more decent country is appealing, I admit, but I know I'm not going anywhere. I've learned that leaving your home is tricky. If I left my country now, I'd just be repeating myself, having already physically left a place that refused to leave me. Man, you know, it takes a long time to get to that, though, doesn't it?
71 years and counting, close to 72, yeah. Something like that. Yeah, it takes a while. Of course, I'm a slow learner. Somebody else, Joe, might have gotten to that a lot quicker.
Yeah, I don't know about that. But it because all the planets have to align, and that takes some time. But now, do you feel, does it comfort you that place is still with you? Not that you could leave it and live in Maine as you do and still have it be very much a part of you. Is there a comfort in that now that replaced the I have to get as far away from it as I can?
Oh, absolutely. There's absolutely a comfort in that. As I say in the essay, one of the things that you know, this slowed me down when I was trying to become a writer. One of the things that slowed me down was that I was still seeing the place that I came from through my mother's eyes, and she was the one who really wanted to escape. One of the things that I finally had to kind of own up to myself more than to her, more than anybody else. And once I realized it, I thought, okay, fine. Now I kind of know what I didn't know before and what was getting in my way. Was that all the things that my mother wanted me to escape from, lack of opportunity and all of those the things that she was trying to escape from too, not just for me, but it dawned on me at some point. Maybe it wasn't exactly a blinding revelation. It didn't knock me off my horse or anything like that. But at some point, it dawned on me that I was fortunate. I was born at exactly the right time, in exactly the right place, to exactly the right people. And that would be my biggest strength if I could just let it, if I could get out of my own stupid way, that would prove to be the well of strength that I would need all these decades later writing stories, that if I didn't come to that conclusion about just how lucky I was that my career wasn't going anywhere. So yeah, of course it's an enormous comfort to me at this point in my career, watching my daughters and now my grandchildren growing up to have arrived at that kind of internal peace that you know is important to a writer, a husband, a father, to wake up in the morning with good work to do and people you love and love you, and to know that you're in exactly the right place. And that was a gift that I didn't recognize at the time. Took me a long time to figure out. But what a gift it's turned out to be, Joe.
Absolutely. The story is beautiful and so compassionate and thoughtful. It is Marriage Story, an American memoir. It is a Scribd original. Folks can find out more by going to Scribd.com. I will spell that. S-C-R-I-B-D, Scribd.com. Marriage Story, an American memoir. Rick, it's always a great pleasure to speak to you. I always look forward to these conversations, and I thank you very much, as always, for your candor and your wit and, most of all, your beautiful work.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you very much. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.